Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Gary Wills, whose latest book is Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State, author of several other books, including Lincoln at Gettysburg, The Words That Remade America, Necessary Evil, A History of Mistrust in America, The Negro President, several other books. Gary Wills started out as a conservative with National Review and William F. Buckley.
I didn't talk to Bill for 30 years.
Did you finally reconcile with him?
We did, I'm happy to say. His sister Priscilla, with whom I had kept in touch, a wonderful woman, called up about 3 years ago and said it's kind of silly for people who are such friends at one time not to talk to each other at all. And we got together and resumed our correspondence and ended up on a friendly basis again.
Do you find it odd that politics could split up a friendship that badly?
No, I know many friendships that were split up that badly. In a way, it was conflicting friendships. When I was criticizing the Vietnam War, I called Bill's good friend Henry Kissinger a war criminal. That was something it took him a long time to forgive. And, of course, I had specific things in mind. He authorized the use of flechette bombs in civilized areas, and that's technically a war crime. And so I was not just using empty rhetoric. That and other things he didn't like at all, and of course I didn't like some of the things he was doing. He was very critical of Martin Luther King, saying it's against our anti-communist purpose to criticize America. You know, America has to be always right. That kind of thing split us up for a long time.
I think that your move to the left is directly impacted by the events that you discuss in your book, Bomb Power, which is the history of the modern presidency, or we could call it the imperial presidency, and the national security state. You were a conservative. You were with Bill Buckley. From that perspective, what did you see in terms of the power of the presidency and secrecy?
Well, I was not all that politically aware then. I was a Greek teacher at Johns Hopkins, and I mainly did book reviews for National Review on literature and philosophy and things like that. It was not until the 60s, really, that I began to cover politics, and that was kind of accidental. The first thing I did was a book on Richard Nixon, and that I was kind of dragooned into. I was visiting my parents in Michigan when Harold Hayes of Esquire called up and said, Murray Kempton has had family troubles that make him unable to do an article he had promised on Nixon's comeback in New Hampshire. So I went for the first time that I'd ever covered a political campaign, and I wrote a piece in Esquire to come out before the primaries, but to take them into account as far as possible. I had followed him around Wisconsin and New Hampshire. And then Dorothy DeSantolano of Houghton Mifflin called me up and said, you've got to do a book about Richard Nixon. And I said, I don't think he's going to win. So I was not a very good prognosticator. And she said, it doesn't matter. What you're really talking about is in this article is America.
In 1968.
Yeah. And so she said, whether he wins or loses, what you are saying is that he's a nice focus through which to look at America. And that caused something of a stir, especially after Watergate, when it came out in paperback. And then it was being taught in courses all over America. I was at Yale one time, and they said it's being taught in 5 different courses. Because some people claimed that I had predicted Watergate, which was not true. But I had identified some weaknesses in the man that seemed to be confirmed by Watergate.
The connection here is that in an interview about your book, Bomb Power, you discuss how E. Howard Hunt of the Watergate burglars was kind of a model for the new national security elite.
In terms of social class, he was different from Bill Buckley. But he was actually his boss in Mexico when they were both in the CIA. Once you get this elite which has access to secrets by getting clearance, then you do get people who are not members of the old boys club in the normal sense, but they are part of this club that can dismiss opinion from outsiders because they're not in the know. A good example of that is Leslie Groves, the general at the Manhattan Project. He was another person from not a very prominent social standing, and he was bossing around these world-famous physicists because he was in the very heart of the national security state in its inception. He had access to all the secrets. In fact, he was guarding them. He was making sure that other people didn't get to them. So then we do have this group of people who can dismiss all other opinion. For instance, when the first Bush wanted to go into Kuwait, he asked for support from Congress, not for a declaration of war, and none of them do that anymore, but for support. And Congress held hearings, and Admiral Crowe, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, came before the Foreign Affairs Committee and said, you know, we haven't really given sanctions a very long time to work. Why don't we try them a little longer, and maybe war will not be necessary, but if they don't work, then we can go to war then. Secretary of State Jim Baker came before the same committee shortly after and said, well, Admiral Crowe no longer has clearance. He can't read the cables, so his opinion is not something you should take seriously, which means nobody's opinion can be taken seriously except for this core of people who have access to the secrets.
Now, what happened with Iraq? Because they played the same game. Cheney and Bush played the same game, and when the secrets, quote-unquote, came out, there was no uranium, there were no weapons of mass destruction. The entire thing was a fraud.
Yeah. And what they turned up was proof that they were determined to overthrow Saddam and bring about regime change even before the terrorist attack on the Twin Towers. So they just moved up the schedule.
Well, Gary Wiltz, let's go back to the origins of your book, Bomb Power. The thesis behind Bomb Power is that the national security state and the power of the presidency really began because only one person could push that button and start a war. It's a thesis that some people dispute on the grounds that it almost seems to single out one area rather than the massive military-industrial complex and how we got, say, from point A to point B. I mean, you're putting your finger on one trigger.
Yes, I am. First of all, the Manhattan Project broke every law imaginable, broke the Constitution, broke every law. It was outside the chain of military command. It was outside congressional control. Congress didn't even know about it. Senator Truman, when he was investigating the misuse of federal funds during the war, never caught on to that. As vice president, he didn't know. So this was the great secret that we had kept, and it was successful. So other breaking of the law during a wartime is reversed when the war ends. Suspension of habeas corpus in the Civil War, detention of the Japanese Americans. This one, nobody thinks of it as illegal, what went on, because it was taken as a model. Everything that Leslie Groves did, the CIA would later do. He tried to assassinate a foreign leader, Werner Heisenberg. He detained people. He threatened to draft physicists if they were reluctant and use them as army people. Then Truman threatened to draft the railway strikers. So when they came out, there was this great secret that not only had to be kept, but developed. And, of course, eventually it was developed into the hydrogen bomb. But it had to be deployed, and it had to have bases around the world. First, the Strategic Air Command kept bombs in the air 24 hours a day and had to have places to refuel and land and be repaired. Then submarines had to have bases. Then missiles. We had to put missiles in Turkey. To do that, we had to invent a whole series of new agencies, the NSC, the NSA, the CIA, all of which were arranged around the initial effort to keep and deploy the secret of the bomb. And, of course, Truman was given a power that no president had ever been given. The Atomic Energy Commission said only the president can launch a nuclear attack without any controls from Congress or anybody else. Now, that had never happened before, and of course it went in the face of the Constitution that says Congress has the power to declare war. But it didn't stop there. When it came time for the Korean War, Dean Acheson said to Truman, well, this is not a nuclear war, not yet anyway. And so technically your immunity from all criticism for initiating a war does not apply, but we've got to protect your initiative to start war. So don't ask for any permission from Congress at all.
So this is really the basis for Gulf of Tonkin, Iraq War, invasions of Grenada, Lebanon, even Clinton putting troops in the former Yugoslavia, Panama, Noriega, everything.
And for about 100 coups or attempted coups that tried to replace foreign governors that we didn't like. Yeah, the power of a president to initiate war spread out from that first grant and from all of the things that were created to protect it, so that it was normal up until the 1940s to go to war only if Congress declared war, whether it was the War of 1812, the Mexican War, World War I, World War II. And since Korea, when Acheson said, don't get a declaration of war from Congress, there has not been a single declaration of war by Congress. So that's when we entered a whole different way of treating the executive. And, you know, there are key symbols, important symbols. For instance, the president now, with the football and the button, is somewhat omnipotent. And the very title Commander-in-Chief, which started out being a modest title, is now made synonymous with the presidency. Commander-in-Chief was a term that we got from the British when they had several admirals in a sector of the ocean. They would say, you're all equal rank, but for the purpose of this theater and this campaign, one of you will be Commander-in-Chief. And when Washington went to Boston, there were militia generals and others, and Congress said, you'll be the Commander-in-Chief. So when the Constitution was drawn up, they said that the president will be Commander-in-Chief of the military and of the militias only when called into national service. That's the extent of his Commander-in-Chief power. But now we call him our Commander-in-Chief and say he's Commander-in-Chief of the country. And in order to protect that misunderstanding, Donald Rumsfeld, when he was Secretary of Defense, said, we're going to abolish all of our other Commander-in-Chief titles, because we had that title used exactly as the British had used it. We had SINCPAC, Commander-in-Chief in the Pacific, over the various forces there. SINCEUR, Commander-in-Chief in Europe, and Commanders-in-Chief in other sectors. Well, he abolished all that because he said, we've got to think of only one Commander-in-Chief. So when Nixon wanted Archibald Cox fired from the Watergate investigation, he had his aide, General Haig, call up the Justice Department and say, fire Archibald Cox. And the Attorney General said, no, I can't do that. Congress didn't set it up that way. Then he turned to Donald Rumsfeld and told him to fire Cox. And Rumsfeld said no. And he said, your Commander-in-Chief has given you an order. You must obey. Well, he wasn't the Commander-in-Chief of Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld's a civilian. I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying, whatever else he is, the president is not my Commander-in-Chief. I'm not in the Army. And I got incredibly angry letters saying, if he's not your Commander-in-Chief, you're not an American. Get out of this country. So now citizenship is obedience to the Commander-in-Chief. And this extends even to this, that now, since Reagan, when a president gets off a plane or a helicopter, he's saluted by the Marines, and he salutes back. Why? He's not a military officer. Saluting is supposed to be for an officer in uniform. A general outside of uniform is not saluted. And the presidency is not a military office. That was proved in a case when George Washington died. Part of his estate was in New York State, and the heirs there said, Dutchess County gives a tax exemption to veterans, so we should have a tax exemption for George Washington's service. And it went to court, and the court said, well, it's true. He did military service before the Constitution, before the United States existed. The Continental Congress hired him and pensioned him, and that was the end of his military service. But as president, he's not a military officer. He gets no military pay, gets no military pension. He can't be court-martialed, as every other military officer can. He can only be impeached, which is a civilian offense. He's a civilian in charge of the military. That's the distinction of the Constitution, that it brought in civilian rule of the military. People were proud of the fact that we're not a banana republic with a general ruling the country. But now, Commander-in-Chief has taken on a military aura which doesn't belong there at all. We should go back to being proud of civilian control of the military.
We've gone so far afield from the Constitution as it is. When I spoke with you a few years ago, I asked, is the republic under threat? And your response was, the republic is always under threat.
Sure it is, as Benjamin Franklin said. A republic, if you can keep it.
Gary Wills, is there a higher security clearance than the President of the United States?
No, the highest security clearance would apply to him, but to other people, too. Of course, he has a kind of distinct position. Nobody challenges his clearances.
And the President is still running things. I mean, sometimes it feels with Obama that he's limited in what he can do, that forces beyond him, however we want to describe it, yeah, stay away from conspiracy, but military-industrial complex, the entire weight of, I guess, the government and the forces around the government would constrain the president.
Yeah, but they're all executive forces. They're not congressional and they're not Supreme Court.
Right.
Everything is under the executive power with the president on at the top. And it's true that the president can't wield these instruments at will sometimes because they balk. They're like Frankenstein's monster. You make it, but then you have to duck. They get their own turf, and they get their own assets, as they call them, which can be embarrassments. So trying to rein in the forces, even when a president cooperates, is very difficult. Ford cooperated with the Church Committee, for instance, that tried to rein in the CIA. But when the head of the CIA gave over the proof that there were assassination attempts, he was treated as a traitor by the CIA and by many people outside, including some in the White House, including Dick Cheney at the time. When Richard Helms, the former director, defied Congress and lied to Congress, he was praised. He was considered a hero. So this is a part of the creation of the whole national security state that means it gets an inertia of its own and a kind of entrenched bureaucratic force. Also, as I say, when they use other people for coups, for instance, when Kermit Roosevelt overthrew Mossadegh in Iran and brought back the Shah, he hired thugs and street fighters and all kinds of riffraff to do it. And those people hang around, and they know secrets. And many of them are soldiers of fortune who are not necessarily going to be very responsive to leadership. And we've accumulated over the years thousands of these people. You know, there are more contractors now in Afghanistan and Iraq than there are military people. And for a long time, during the coalition period, they were accountable to no one. They were not accountable to the United States courts, to the British courts, to the coalition government itself, which had no judicial apparatus. So it took some guts for Al Franken finally to say, contractors have been raping American women soldiers. Contractors that do that, and he named them, should be instantly dismissed, have no more money from contra. He was criticized thoroughly, saying, you're undermining the war effort. You know, we have these people, and they have us at their mercy. We need them, and we can't control them. This was a problem with Rumsfeld, his cheap, quick, shock and awe army, sending in minimal forces, but he was farming out all of these services to contractors, people to guard our embassies, guard our troops.
Did we really save money that way?
Oh, no.
I didn't think
so. The contractors get paid more than the soldiers, which is what the soldiers resent.
So what's going on? Just another layer of extra legality?
Yeah, sure. A penumbra of semi-thugs. And they keep popping up. For instance, the break-in of the Watergate was done by some Cubans who had been involved in the Bay of Pigs. You know, they're assets, as the CIA calls them, so you use them.
What we've got, essentially, is a decision to circumvent any kind of oversight by the Bush administration by farming these out. Oh, we're going to farm it out and save money. But it's got nothing to do with that. It's got to do with just hiding everything.
Yes. That's what secrets are for now. You know, the original rationale and the justifiable one for secrecy is that you shouldn't tell the enemy what you're up to when you have an enemy. If you're going to invade Europe, don't tell them when and where D-Day is going to occur. But once D-Day has occurred, there's no reason to keep a secret anymore. Now we keep our secrets forever as a matter of principle. Who are we hiding it from? My favorite Doonesbury strip, Gary Trudeau gave me the original to hang on my wall, is of his character Fred going to Cambodia. And he sees this flattened country and a ruined house and a couple standing in front of it. And Fred says, this is historic ground. This is the site of the secret bombing of Cambodia. And the man said, oh, no, it was not a secret. I said to Martha, see, there are the bombs. It was not to keep it secret from the Cambodians, obviously. They knew. It was to keep it from Congress. Nixon didn't want Congress to know that he had started a war with another country without telling Congress, and then he was using money in Cambodia that they had authorized for Vietnam.
I just came back from 2 weeks in Thailand, and one thing about leaving the country is you suddenly realize how provincial and how limited our perspective is in this country, even if we're trying to be aware.
Yeah, I go to Italy every year, and we travel in other places too. From way back, decades back, my wife and I always noticed that we followed stories in the press in Italy and in Spain, where her sister lives, and in England, extensive coverage of international affairs. And we came home, And even in the New York Times and the Washington Post, stories we had been following disappeared. I asked some people abroad, off and on at various times, why do you suppose that is? And they said, well, your country is buffered by oceans away from us, and most of us are ex-colonial countries. Uncle Harry served in India and that kind of thing. And we had a worldwide fleet when we were the British. In Italy, we border on Africa and we border on Spain. So they are much more aware than we are of all these things. And for a long time, Americans were proud of their isolation. And we were not a world power until World War II. Since then, our access to information has been severely controlled by the secrecy that involves everything our government does. For instance, the secrecy about Cuba. The Cubans knew that Operation Mongoose was going on, that we were trying to kill Fidel Castro, sabotage his crops, mine his harbors. And they thought, and some of our military thought, that this was a prelude to invading Cuba. So Fidel Castro, who was at first reluctant to accept missiles from Khrushchev, because why get involved in a nuclear exchange when, if that happens at all, it's one thing that's certain is that your whole island's going to disappear in the blink of an eye. It would just be evaporated. But when he thought that America was going to invade him, he thought missiles could be a deterrent to prevent that invasion, with no intention of using them in an offensive way. But President Kennedy got up and said there's no conceivable reason why they're there for defensive purposes. No conceivable defensive reason for these missiles. They're clearly offensive. They're there to attack us. That was a lie. But Americans didn't know it, and they still celebrate this as a great moment of victory for Kennedy, that he faced down Khrushchev over the missiles. We are so regularly lied to. You know, LBJ said, if you knew what I know about Vietnam, you would realize that I'm acting prudently and justly. But you can't know, because there are all these secrets. Well, Daniel Ellsberg had helped draw up the Pentagon Papers. McNamara said at one point, things are going so bad over there. What's going on? Give me a history of the engagement. And Ellsberg knew that the Pentagon Papers had no great revelations. They were contradictory. They were erroneous. They're full of errors. So he leaked them to call the bluff of LBJ and say, see, you didn't have the basis of prudent and just action. Well, they were leaked during the Nixon administration, and some around Nixon said, why are you getting upset? Why are you prosecuting Ellsberg? Why are you trying to prevent the publication of these? They don't affect you at all. They're all about LBJ's time. Most of them go back 20 years by this time. And he said, no, I can't allow people to challenge the president's right to keep secrets. And so now you keep these secrets even though they're obsolete and of no use, simply as a matter of presidential prerogative.
Gary Wiltz, here we are now in 2010, and we have a new president. You've written a series of articles for the New York Review of Books about Obama. We have not seen an end to torture. We have not seen even a rollback of the national security state. There's a quote about Leon Panetta that it appears that he's become an invasion of the body snatchers. He's become one of them.
Yeah.
What the hell is going on?
Well, I think a person running for president doesn't really know the extent of our secret empire, of our 800 locations around the world, of secret places like Diego Garcia, which are off the map. And when he comes in, I'm sure members of the national security state and its various branches come to him and say, go slow here. It took us a long time to build up this apparatus and these assets, and you may need them down the road. And if you try to undercut these people, some of them will turn out to be disloyal or demoralized or inefficient. You need the CIA, so you have to cultivate it. And I'm sure that that's pretty intimidating to a president. And so, as you say, we're told that we're not going to torture in the future, but we're also told, well, we can't investigate it in the past. We can't release photographs. And you know it just happened in Britain that Britain released some torture photographs after Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said, don't do it. And she says, this will inhibit the exchange of information with the British. That's so cutting off your own. We need information about terrorism. Intelligence is the principal weapon against terrorism, and we need the intelligence agencies of all the countries that are cooperating with us. And so for that to happen is a perfect example of this being intimidated by your own instruments. And it's true, Panetta said, well, we might have to consider extraordinary rendition somewhere down the road. And we might have to use military tribunals for some people who are imprisoned. So there is that inertia that can, I think, kind of hypnotize or paralyze a president when he begins to realize all of the instruments that he has that have been kept secret from everybody, including him.
And we're still involved in two wars, particularly in Afghanistan. And Obama comes in and says we're going to slowly get out, and we're not. Mm-hmm. Would it have been any different with Hillary Clinton?
Oh, no. She's more hawkish than he is. She voted for the Iraq War, and she never apologized. Biden voted for it and did apologize. No, she's a tough person. See, Obama backed himself into Afghanistan in a kind of silly way. During the campaign, he rightly said, we shouldn't have taken troops out of Afghanistan and sent them to Iraq. We were on to Osama at Tora Bora, and we should have pushed through to that. From going to that quite reasonable position to the idea that Iraq bad, Afghanistan good, he broke another of his promises. He said, I'm not against war, I'm against dumb wars. Well, Afghanistan is a very, very dumb war. It's got no government to speak of, and what there is corrupt through and through. It's got a narcotic economy that is totally unbreakable. It's got murderous terrain. It's got factional divisions within. The idea that we can establish even enough security for our own military operations there is absurd. And think of the waste we're pouring into that place. Money and men and women and materiel, when our army is stretched, when people are getting 4 deployments, when the National Guard is being misused on a grand scale, when Stieglitz says the sheer attrition, the grinding up of our weaponry, of our tanks, our artillery, our planes, is something that it will take years to replace. Terrorism has metastasized. It crosses borders. It's not a country you can attack now. It's a network that you have to pursue with intelligence and police efforts. You know, we get terrorist attacks coming out of London. You know, are we going to invade England?
You know, you left out one thing here. You didn't mention the Department of Homeland Security and these no-fly lists that nobody could penetrate.
Yeah, right. One of the things that's happened since World War II, we came out of the war, and emergency powers did not lapse because the emergency did not. And emergency after emergency has followed, and fear has been the driving force that if a president wants to get support for something, you have to do what Arthur Vandenberg said to Harry Truman. Truman wanted to send aid to Greece on the grounds that if he didn't, maybe the communists would take over sometime. And a lot of people opposed that because the Greek leaders had been collaborating with fascism. And so Truman called in Vandenberg, who had cooperated with him on bipartisan efforts during the war, and said, can I get some Republican support to give aid to Greece? And he said, well, Mr. President, for you to do that, you're going to have to scare hell out of the country. And he did. The Truman Doctrine speech was a very scary one, and it launched us really into the Cold War. It's the one that said that wherever democracy is threatened, which of course meant wherever communism is, we have to go there, no matter what. So we went right out of the emergency of World War II, a worldwide commitment, into the Truman Doctrine, which is another worldwide commitment, driven by fear of communism. Now, there was a rational fear of communism, and there was the irrational. And the irrational was fear of domestic as well as foreign subversion and the creation of an expanded role for the FBI and a brand new role for the CIA and for intelligence agencies within the various military services.
In 1990, communism collapsed pretty much across the board, yet there was no call for a dismantling of the national security state, even though there was no longer an enemy.
That's right. Senator Moynihan said, you would expect, in normal circumstances, that the end of the communist threat would mean a slacking off of classification of secrets. He said, far from it, it was accelerated. It went into a gallop.
Now we've got this Department of Homeland Security. We've got these bizarre searches at airports. Supposedly, you know, we're doing it out of some kind of fairness or, quote, political correctness, that we're going to strip search a Moroccan, 22-year-old Moroccan national with the same ferocity that we strip search a 75-year-old Mormon grandmother from Salt Lake City.
My friend Studs Terkel, when he was 90, 6 years before his death, was in a wheelchair when he traveled to airports, and they practically dismantled the wheelchair to find the bomb inside it. And he said, I'm sure glad you're afraid of a 90-year-old terrorist.
Is the only purpose of that to scare us?
Part of it, I think, is to reassure us, to make people think that flight is safe. During World War II, I was 7, 8, 9, and we had these scrap iron drives and these scrap rubber drives. Aside from all the rationing of food and gas and clothing materials. And my sister and I went out and collected scrap rubber from all around the neighborhood. We have pictures of us with our little wagon bringing in the thing to the stations. Well, it turns out that none of that was ever used. It was not really processable in any economically feasible way. It just made people feel that they were contributing to the war effort. So it was a morale booster. And I think some of these searches are that kind of thing, to make people feel that they're part of an effort that makes them safer in the great war that we're now in.
But, of course, here you've got someone who was tagged as a terrorist, and he wasn't properly searched, and he got onto a plane.
I know. That's so terrible. And, of course, the Brits are the principal ones at fault there. The Brits are weird. On the one hand, they have the National Secrets Act and no First Amendment. On the other hand, they have a tradition of independence and privacy. Don't invade another person's privacy by strip searches. So they have kind of conflicting cultural traditions.
Gary Wills, let's talk a little bit more about the United States here. When I was in Thailand, I was switching the dials, and I came across Fox News, which struck me even more bizarrely than watching it here. There's a level of animosity and anger that permeates that station. In talking to people from Thailand, I said, aren't you interested, monks, people like that, in coming to the U.S.? And maybe it's that. No one wants to visit the United States.
Really? Many years ago, 20 years ago, when we were in Japan, my wife and I, young people were very afraid to go to America because they watched all these crime things on TV. They heard about the crime rate in America, the truthful statistics, and of course their crime rate is very low, even though they have their own little mafia. We were amazed that at the universities, thousands of bikes are out there in front of the buildings, none of them locked, and most houses don't have locks on them. So their picture of America was of this very dangerous place. One woman, young woman, asked my wife, do you walk on the streets at night in New York? And she said, sure. She said, you must be very brave. Really, a lot of people want to come to America because it's rich and it's glamorous. And it's the source of movies and television and that kind of thing. But what's amazing is the last years that we've been going to Europe, the total contempt for Bush and the kind of pitying attitude toward us. Don't you feel awful that you have this government? You know, our approval rating sank to historic lows. The last times we've been there since Obama, it shot up. Maybe they're being too optimistic. There was a lot of hope for Obama, abroad as well as at home. And the Cairo speech did a lot to affect that. And I presume that's why he was given the Nobel Prize. It was a prize for hope. But his time is running out for living up to those hopes.
You said in one of your articles that you think a lot of this has to do with his wanting to become a two-term president, and you would rather have him just get out of these countries and be a one-term president.
Yeah.
But that might bring us Sarah Palin as president.
I hope not. You know, the interesting thing about Obama, he's omnidirectionally placatory. That's the way he was as the first black editor of the Harvard Law Journal. When people remember his service, they say, He was totally open and totally fair. He would even get conservative judges to write articles for the journal. Everybody was welcome. And that kind of tactic served him in some of his social work. Chicago's social work has a lot of conflicting turfs, pastors and ministers, and they all fight with each other. And he had to try to draw them together. Well, I think he's trying to do that again to a crazy extent. He wants to be a post-racial, post-partisan, post-red state, blue state president. But he can't when, you know, the red states are not going to go along with that. And the racists are going to be racists, continue to be. I am not a mind reader, but I suppose that one of the things he brings to the presidency is he realizes that he himself is changed, that he's a shock to some people, the first black American president. And maybe he should not inject too much change. So he's clearly been striving for continuity, too much, I think. For instance, he becomes well known for attacking the war on Iraq, but he makes his Secretary of State, his Vice President, his Secretary of Defense, his two generals in Afghanistan, people who either voted for, supported, or waged the war in Iraq. Now, that's continuity, all right. The same with the banking problems. He comes in and he appoints Geithner and Summers and Bernanke, people who were the ones who got us into the problem. Again, we have continuity. He wanted to have health care, and the first people he called in were the AMA, the Big Pharma, the insurance companies, and he even foolishly boasted early in the spring that this is the first time that we've had all of these forces on our side. They weren't on his side. They were snookering him. Even now that they claim he's waking up and he's trying to get tougher, he's still trying to have bipartisan meetings saying, I'm still open to ideas. You know, a year later, he's still open to ideas.
Well, he still has Geithner in there. I mean, I don't understand that.
I know. As we were saying earlier on, there is a certain inertia to the national security state that's hard to budge. The thing he should have done was to say, our first priority in health care is to cut costs. And the only way to cut costs is to have a public option that will force the insurance companies to compete. Because he didn't do that, all of these plans that have come along later are going to cost more, and that's the big hit against them. And it allows a lot of wiggle room for the insurance companies. You know, the longer it goes on, the worse it becomes, the worse the plans become.
Well, I keep thinking that one thing Bush did that maybe was easier for him to do because he was going with the establishment was sometimes stake a position that might be publicly unpopular and then say, but I know I'm right. And this is something Obama hasn't done. And, you know, I'm looking at the area of, say, gay marriage or even Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where he wouldn't lose support at all. And at least people would say, you believe in something. Yeah. And he won't even do that.
Yeah, you must give Bush credit that he was not afraid to work from his base. He was shameless, but also fearless in saying, I want tax cuts for the rich. He just came out and said it. He disguised it somewhat, said other people will get some too. You know, sometimes he made a mistake, but he did it again in a principled way. He said, I want to privatize Social Security. Well, that was a no-starter, but it was gutsy, and it worked from his base. He was helped along by a truly supine Democratic congressional delegations. The Democrats still had a majority in the Senate when he came in as president, and they didn't do a thing to impede him or challenge him. When Cheney said, you can't know who I'm consulting about energy policy, they didn't subpoena him. When Hillary Clinton said, you can't know who I'm consulting on health care, the Republicans forced her to reveal it. The Democrats didn't force Cheney to do that. When Bush put up people who were clearly unqualified, Ashcroft, for instance, the Democrats just went along, although they knew Ashcroft from way back. He'd been one of them. Remember, Ashcroft is the only attorney general who, when he came to Congress, had to be anointed because that's the scriptural way, and they couldn't find anything in his Washington apartment except Crisco oil. And so he was anointed with Crisco. That's the man we make the attorney general of the United States.
More seriously, we have a Supreme Court now, which seems by a 5-4 majority to be overturning precedents right and left.
Yeah.
What's your take on it? Do you think there's any shot that, other than a sudden death, that moderates might get the upper hand?
Well, unfortunately, the conservatives are the younger ones on the court, and some are very young. To go after the court was a very deliberate strategy of the right wing. the Federalist Society, the people who were championing the unitary executive from the time of Reagan on. And you remember in the campaign, Bush Gore, the right wing made a big thing about saying, we're electing the person who will nominate Supreme Court justices. The left wing hardly ever talked about that. And, of course, that was a tremendous priority. It was in the Reagan administration, Ed Meese's Justice Department, his aides, who came up with the unitary executive theory, which the Federalist Society adopted, and most of the recent appointees have come from the Federalist Society. One of the many things Cheney did that no other vice president had done was vet the Supreme Court nominees. That was part of this wide-ranging authority Cheney had in the White House. And it was said at the time he must be vetting them for conservative views on things like social issues, like gay marriage or abortion. It wasn't at all. He was vetting them on the unitary executive. And they passed with flying colors. They're the ones who will defend all of these national security state usurpations.
But they also talk a lot about being originalists. There's nothing originalist in that philosophy.
No, no. It goes against the Constitution. You know, the unitary executive means that that Congress has no oversight over the agencies. It was invented to defend the deregulation measures of Ronald Reagan. The Congress was saying, wait a minute, we set up those agencies, and we have right to oversee them, because after all, we can impeach any executive officer. And how can we impeach if we don't know what's going on, and if we have no control over the agencies that we set up? They said, oh, no, you turn it over to the president. The president is in charge of his branch, and you can't touch it anymore. Totally unconstitutional. But that's what they said. First of all, it was to do things like deregulate. Then it became things like run interrogation, extraordinary interrogation, or initiate foreign hostilities. All that has now become part of the unitary executive. So this straight line from the Manhattan Project to now is confirmed over and over. Let me give you one more example. Because of the fear of nuclear war, an attack now could decapitate the government, knock off the top tier of rulers, Congress came up with new laws for presidential succession. It goes from president to vice president to Speaker of the House and on down through cabinet members. But in the Ronald Reagan administration, they said, well, wait a minute, we can't go along with this. Because, say, it gets to the Speaker of the House, he or she doesn't have the techniques. To launch nuclear weapons is very complicated and technical. It involves overcoming checks against accident. It involves retargeting and renavigating, depending on where the attack is coming from. So the president has technicians who drill him on that when he comes in and would be instantly there if he had to launch the war. But they said, Speaker of the House can't do that. So they set up a program, a secret program, in which Cheney and Rumsfeld, who were White House staffers, and other members of the cabinet were called and said, leave your home tonight. Don't tell your wife where you're going. We're going to an undisclosed location, first official use of that term. And when they got there, they chose the highest cabinet member to lead them. And then they played war. They launched nuclear attacks. They learned how to do it. And they were ready to do it in case of a threat. Well, that procedure was actually followed. With the attack on the Twin Towers, Cheney was still in the White House, but now the vice president. The president was flying around somewhere. And Cheney was informed that there were more planes flying toward targets, more terrorist attacks up there. He thought, plural, several planes. And he scrambled Air Force jets to shoot them down. Now, the one went down before the planes could reach it. Scooter Libby, who was standing by his elbow, said he never called in the president to clear it with the president. The argument was, those planes are getting near the target where there's no time to talk. We just have to act. And so he called the president after he gave the order. But Libby said it took him no more time to give the order than it takes a batter to decide to hit a pitch.
2006, Bush seems to have kind of given Cheney the heave-ho.
Well, he must resent the fact that so much went on that he didn't even know about. Cheney's attitude is probably that of the CIA. We have to give the president plausible deniability.
Gary Wills, now we've covered a lot here, and all of it is very depressing. Is there any way that we as citizens can pull us out of, I guess, what Gore Vidal calls perpetual war for perpetual peace?
Yeah. Well, it'll be difficult. You know, the efforts that have been made in the past, the War Powers Act, the Church Committee, even some good efforts by Clinton. Clinton started a declassification program, which was very laudable, but Bush instantly reversed it and made more secrets than ever. They failed. The only thing I can think of is to find the few courageous people in Congress. There are always just a few, and they're always vilified, and throw great support behind them, look for more of them to elect, and try to make them models of constitutional rectitude that'll shame the others. You know, a good example is that of that is what I gave of Al Franken, you know, finally standing up and saying, contractors who rape our women soldiers should be cut off. You know, that seems reasonable enough, but it's something nobody's done and that he was attacked for doing. We should find more people like that, the two people who voted against the Tonkin Gulf resolution. There are always the one or two courageous people, and if you celebrate them, that their number might grow.
Gary Wills, now that you've finished this book, what are you working on now?
Giuseppe Verdi. I've been writing off and on articles on opera, and I've been an opera fan from childhood. And I've also written about and published one book and another one coming out on Shakespeare. So my book is Verdi's Shakespeare. Verdi did three operas from Shakespeare's plays. No other person has done that. There have been 200 operas based on Shakespeare. Most of them are failures, and the few that succeeded, like Benjamin Britten's Midsummer Night's Dream, were one-shot affairs. Verdi hit a home run three times in a row.
There's Otello,
Falstaff, and Macbeth.
That's the book, is on those
That's
three
the book,
operas.
Yeah.
You've been listening to an interview with Gary Wills, whose latest book is Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.